Welcome to the Barnes Review History Hour. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Friday, March 3rd, 2023. The Barnes Review History Hour is a program where I will be interviewing contributors to the Barnes Review History Magazine, a bi-monthly print and digital publication dedicated to bringing history into accord with the facts, as well as other special guests. Please do consider subscribing to the magazine if you are not already. Check out barnesreview.org for all the details. Today, I'm joined by Carl Hamers, a regular contributor to the Barnes Review. All right, Carl Hamers, welcome back to the program, sir. How are you this afternoon?
Excellent, John. Good to be with you again.
Yeah, good. It's good to connect now that we're in the new year. We did a couple programs last year, and they were great discussions, and I would encourage people to check those out if they miss them. You are a regular contributor to the Barnes Review History Magazine, which is, of course, a bi-monthly print revisionist magazine dedicated to bringing history into accord with the facts. You have also written for the Occidental Observer, I know, an outstanding website that I've followed for many years now. And I know you also maintain your own Substack page, and you also just published your very first book, which is titled Covert COVID Culprits, an Inquest Chronicle, which is also available from the Barnes Review. And we will talk a bit more about your Substack page and your new book as we wrap up this program. But just to get started, I want to mention that we just sent the March and April 2023 edition of the Barnes Review to the printer a couple weeks ago. So right now it is being printed, it is being bound, and it will soon be shipped out to all of our subscribers. If you are not subscribing to the magazine, you really should be. Go to barnesreview.org for subscription details. And please do support one of the last revisionist history magazines in existence in our modern era. And Carl, I know you've been writing for the Barnes Review for a number of years now. So to me, I mean, really, this is like one of the most important publications in existence, certainly in this country, when we're seeing our history be systematically suppressed and erased, and just, you know, the attack on authentic historical inquiry and free speech. So I would really encourage people to subscribe to the magazine. We also have a huge library of censored and suppressed books for sale as well. So while you're on the website, check out the bookstore. There's a lot of great titles there. So anyways, did you want to say anything about the Barnes Review generally? And then I kind of want to just go through some of the stories that are going to be in this upcoming issue, but I don't know if you have any comments about the magazine in general.
Just briefly, it is encouraging to see how much good independent media is emerging, you know, from the substratum of which Barnes has been for a long time. But there are others, you know, it's not as the oppression, the suppression, the censorship intensifies, so does the response. And I'm just thrilled to be part of the honest history that's increasingly available more and more. I just heard on Fash the Nation podcast that them talking about this very thing, the quality and quantity of good independent media that's now available.
Yeah, no, we've definitely made a lot of progress over the course of the past 10 or 15 years for sure. And the Barnes Review has been publishing since 1994, so they've been at this a very, very long time. And I think I first started subscribing to the magazine in like 2010 or 2011. I remember discovering it through listening to Michael Collins Piper, the late Michael Collins Piper, who authored a number of books, and he was affiliated with American Free Press and the Barnes Review for pretty much his entire career. And I've always found it to be an excellent publication. I still like having like a print, you know, physical newspaper or magazine to pick up and read. So, you know, it's becoming increasingly more and more difficult to maintain like a print publication anymore. But the Barnes Review is still going strong. Yeah.
I've always felt like the Barnes print issues are like collector's items. They're works of art.
Yeah, exactly.
And particularly, I just found out before our call that my article will be on the cover. That's my second article that's been a cover article. The first one was Hitler versus the Rothschilds. And it's just a thrill to me to see that my article depicted as the cover art and, you know, the presentation.
Yeah, absolutely. And the cover of the magazine for this issue, the March and April 2023 issue, is outstanding. And Paul Angel, the executive editor, does a great job putting together the magazine and coming up with the covers and using some great photographs and, you know, just putting together a very, very professional and, you know, just impressive publication. And I think anybody that takes a look at the cover will have to agree with me. And I'll have an image of the cover of this issue when I post this podcast program. And of course, it will be available from the Barnes Review, barnesreview.org, if you want to check it out on the website. So anyways, let me just briefly, I want to sort of focus on your article, which, as you mentioned, is the lead article in this issue. I just want to briefly go over the table of contents. Your article is first, it's National Socialism in America Before World War II Broke Out. So it's sort of a history of National Socialism in America leading up to World War II, a topic that we're going to discuss in some detail today. We also have an article from Remy Tremblay, who's a Canadian editor and journalist. He also publishes his own magazine. He wrote an article on Belgium's fascist post-World War I opponents of Leon Degrelle, which is a pretty interesting article. It was a shorter article on the shorter side for the Barnes Review, but a really interesting article. We had an article by John Weir, who wrote basically a biography of William Joyce, who was actually born in America, but he ended up becoming one of Britain's top dissidents and ended up broadcasting directly from Germany and sort of getting the German perspective to an English-speaking world. Very interesting article.
Yes, Lord Haw Haw was his radio personality, and he was actually Irish.
Right, yeah, that's right. He was Irish. He was born in America and lived much of his life in England. Ended up becoming a major target of the British state, to say the least. He ended up being executed for treason, in the aftermath of World War II. So that was an excellent article by John Weir, who is a long time and regular contributor to the magazine. We had an article by Mike Maines. He reviewed Benjamin Friedman's book Facts Are Facts, which is I remember first discovering that book when I really kind of got started in the alternative media, and it's just really eye opening. I'm sure most listeners are familiar with Benjamin Friedman, but that book Facts Are Facts is really an account, like a very suppressed account of World War I, the machinations that led up to World War I and the Balfour Declaration and the Paris Peace Conference, which ended up leading to the Treaty of Versailles. So it's a very, very interesting book, a very suppressed perspective of the machinations that led up to World War I. So that was a great book review. We had an article by, I believe, to my knowledge, a first-time contributor, David Doddridge. He wrote an article titled The Debate in the South Over Arming and Training Black Troops, which is a very long, detailed article about the controversy surrounding, black troops in the Confederate Army, whether, they would be allowed to actually participate in the Army. Very, very interesting article, pretty long as well. I published an article that was basically a review and a promo for Monica Schaefer's new book, which is also available from the Barnes Review. In fact, I think it's featured right on the main website when you go there. Her book is called Sorry Mom, I Was Wrong About the Holocaust, which is also the title of the video that she made that went viral that ended up landing her in some hot water over in Germany, ultimately resulting in a prison stint over there. So I wrote sort of like a promo and a review of that book that's in this issue. We had an article by Antonios Patrick, who's also a regular contributor to the magazine. He wrote part one of an article titled The Vatican and the Rothschilds, which is sort of like a history of the Rothschild banking family and its relationship with the Vatican. Very, very interesting article. And then the very last one is by Frank Joseph, and he wrote an article titled Did Russian Explorers Discover the Lost City in Eastern Atlantic? And it's basically speculating whether or not Russian submariners discovered the lost city of Atlantis in the Eastern Atlantic. A very interesting article. So that's kind of just a rundown of some of the main articles in this issue of the magazine. There are a few other shorter ones. We also, of course, have a personal from the editor, an editorial that I wrote titled Russia Must Perish? Sort of a play on the book Germany Must Perish that was written in 1941 by a Jewish businessman named Theodor Kaufmann, which basically argued for or advocated for a total destruction, an annihilation, a genocide of the German nation. And there are people making those very same calls today when it comes to Russia. So that was the op-ed, the editorial in this issue. And then, of course, we have the History Missed section, which is a regular section of the magazine. We have letters to the editor and a few other shorter articles. So, again, I would encourage everybody to subscribe to the magazine. If you're not already, certainly now is a good time to go out and get a subscription so you can read all the details of Carl's excellent article, National Socialism in America During the Pre-World War II Era, which is part one of what's going to be, I believe, either a 3 or 4 part series. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. And that wasn't the plan starting out. I figured, oh, I'll just summarize this history in one article, and quickly saw that I needed two. And then quickly saw that, well, that's not going to do it. There were so many fascinating and important, you know, historical developments in incidents, new groups forming, that it was going to take, it's probably going to take four to bring it right up to the current day.
Wow. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. It's a huge topic. It's one that I've been very interested in for a very, very long time. I remember really reading a lot about like just the history of the far right in America going back to like 2013, 2014, I remember really getting into this topic. And I did like a deep dive into the Klan, and I actually wrote an article for the Barnes Review back in, I want to say it would have been 2015. It was one of the first articles that I had published in the Barnes Review, dealing with the subject of the Klan, the history of the Klan, and how it's been, you know, in typical fashion, totally distorted by mainstream establishment historians. And of course, that sort of led to researching various aspects of National Socialist-inspired organizations in America. And that's, again, exactly the topic of this first article, which is sort of the early history of it. And this article is basically an examination of the various German-American organizations affiliated with or sympathetic towards National Socialist Germany, culminating in the German-American Bund and its systematic persecution by the state, which again, a topic we'll be talking more about. But just to get started, can you maybe just talk briefly about what got you interested in this topic to begin with?
Yeah, two things. You know, over the few years since I've been studying and pursuing my awakening, that really began in 2015, I've come upon this iconic photograph from the blue seats at Madison Square Garden, looking down at the immense stadium filled with people, 20,000 people. And at the top of the picture is the stage, where there's a 40-foot portrait of George Washington, and next to it, a 40-foot banner of a, you know, National Socialist swastika flag. I just found that so intriguing that there could be a huge public interest enough to fill the stadium, Madison Square Garden, in 1939 for National Socialism. But I never really, you know, pursued a intensive study of the topic. But more recently, you know, within the last year, I've tuned into some of the podcasts and writings of modern day, what have to be considered National Socialist American groups. And they discuss strategy and tactics and, you know, their political approach. And some of them explore how the German National Socialists did it and think about how to apply that to a successful, you know, political, social, economic, and even spiritual campaign in America. And that got me thinking, well, we should really study how American National Socialists have conducted themselves in America's past, you know, to examine successes and failures and build and grow upon the success that they had.
And some of the lessons learned. Yeah, exactly. One theme that you'll see, and we'll talk about this, is the systematic targeting of these sorts of organizations, all, you know, from the very beginning. And that obviously culminated with the persecution of the German-American Bund, as I mentioned. And we saw that, you know, certainly in the aftermath of World War II and even up to the, you know, to the modern day, where now they're trying to basically criminalize people spreading flyers, you know, stating factual information about Jews. I mean, in, I don't know if you saw that proposed bill in Florida, which would basically criminalize anybody distributing literature that's quote unquote anti-Semitic or that has like a religious or ethnic animus. And of course, if you state basic facts about Jews, that is, of course, anti-Semitism to these people. So, yeah, it's a very, very dangerous precedent, but something that we saw going back, you know, if you look at the history of the far right in America and certainly National Socialist inspired organizations in American history.
Well, what one summary we can take from my essay is the strategies that these groups used by switching from a focus on German National Socialism to American patriotism, you know, which I think the German National Socialist Party advised them to do. There was a close working relationship between NSDAP in Germany and Adolf Hitler and the American groups, because the American groups were having an effect on the national perception of Germany, the reputation of Germany. So the German party was very, very much concerned about how the American groups were affecting, you know, American sentiment. Now, the American groups were operating in a climate of Jewish demonization of Germany. So the German party advised the American parties to switch their iconography, their focus, their ideology away from, you know, I don't know what to say, classically German National Socialism, and bring in more American patriotic iconography. And that's why we saw the portrait of George Washington at the Bund rally at the Garden in 1939.
Right. Yeah. You know, I actually have a couple sort of like broad questions that maybe we could address first, and then we can talk like in more detail about the actual specifics of the article, the specific organizations that you, you know, talk about and summarize and sort of highlight. And one of them you're sort of already addressing, and that is how closely aligned or you know, affiliated with the actual German government were these organizations? Because that was always like one of the main claims by U.S. government officials when they were targeting these groups, was that they were basically like a fifth column, right? They were right. Hostile, alien, you know, traitors to America, essentially. How true was that? I mean, were these organizations taking direct orders from Hitler and the NSDAP, or were they more independent than that? Or what was the exact relationship? Do you have any idea?
Yes, I would say the evidence emerges from my research that almost all of these groups had rather direct orders and guidance from the German NSDAP for obvious reasons. Germany was desperate to maintain an alliance and friendship and at least non-interventionism of the United States in European affairs, particularly German affairs. And so they wanted the American National Socialist Party to operate in a way that maintained that, you know, those good relations. Also at the time, kind of in counterpoint to the Jewish propaganda against Germany, National Socialism as an ideology was quite compatible with American patriotism at the time, what we might call national populism in America. So they were natural, you know, allies ideologically, but that was distorted by the Jewish influence. So yes, many times in my studies, and I kind of recount this in the article, that members of the American groups traveled to Germany and consulted directly with Hitler's adjutant, you know, Joseph Goebbels, Hermann Göring, and others of the high-ranking National Socialist Party in Germany about how to conduct themselves in America. I'd say the answer to your question is yes, they were in close cooperation and consultation with the German party, with some exceptions. It was sort of, I don't know, I felt it was kind of charming how the one of the groups, which we'll get to, I think it was Friends of New Germany, refused to completely comply with the German orders. And they continued their operations just because they were so enthusiastic and really saw the benefits of National Socialism in Germany and in America. They kind of defied orders and kept their operations going.
Yeah, wow, that's interesting. Yeah, and that definitely comes across in your article. And that leads me to sort of a follow-up question, in that this relationship that these organizations had with the German government, with German official government leaders, you know, Hitler himself, even. I know some of these German American leaders actually went to Germany and did actually meet with Hitler. What the relationship was, it like subversive in nature? I mean, were they trying to like undermine the U.S. government, or what was the overall goal? Because again, that's sort of like the allegation that these groups were operating on American soil to undermine the U.S. government, to undermine support for the U.S. government, and to operate as sort of like a fifth column, when it seems pretty clear to me that the German government was really more concerned with the image and like the optics of these organizations rather than, you know, actively trying to like undermine or subvert the American government, right?
Right, exactly. No, that's more absurd demonization propaganda, that the American groups were a fifth column, which incidentally derives from the Spanish Civil War. You know, communist populations within a besieged city, you know, held by the nationalists, threatening to foment a kind of military action from within. But no, that's absurd. That's like today saying that, you know, white nationalists are domestic terrorists. It's the same kind of demonization propaganda. No, German Americans were fully supportive of American patriotism, American nationalism. They saw it as closely aligned with German nationalism. Their platforms tended to all be the same throughout the period we're talking about, from 1924 to 1939. And that included American nationalism, opposition to Jewish power in America, opposition to communism, which they saw as primarily Jewish as well. Early on, some of them also opposed the Treaty of Versailles, but they dropped that because it wasn't very much necessarily, you know, a benefit to the United States, although in fact it really was. So no, that was they were actually trying to support American nationalism. And if you maybe towards the end of this segment of our interview, we'll read some of the quotes from the speeches where they actually state their, let me just say it right now, if I can. Today, the German-American Bund has been selected by the overwhelming majority of all upright Americans of German descent to complete the task of attaining to a proper representation in the fields of American political, economic, and social life. So they're fully devoted to everything all-American.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can actually read the, I think it was like the, what would you call it? Like the pamphlet, the,
it was called,
oh, I'm struggling to think of the word, like the pamphlet for the meeting in Madison Square Garden in 1939.
Historic document, Free America.
Yeah. It's a booklet, right? Okay. Sorry. That's the word I was looking for. The booklet.
Yes.
Yeah. Free America, the German American Bund at Madison Square Garden, February 20th, 1939. Yeah. You can find this on archive.org. I'm actually looking at a copy right now. Although the one that I've been able to find on Archive, I think there's like a couple pages missing for some reason, because it's like a scanned document. But anyways, yeah, you can read most of it, and it is absolutely fascinating. One thing that struck me is the obvious American patriotism, but also it seemed very very like Christian influenced. Like there was a strong Christian message as well, right? Is that did you notice that?
No, I can't say I did, but I know at least one of the groups was closely aligned and had, you know, close alliances with Christian identity groups in America at the time. It wouldn't surprise me though, but no, I don't feel like I saw much of a like a Christian affiliation among, although I'm sure they were probably Lutheran and Catholic Germans.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, just for example, the opening address by the National Secretary J. Wheeler Hill, he opens by saying, "My fellow Christian Americans," and then throughout the speech, basically continues to invoke this Christian theme, Christian America versus, you know, alien influences in America, essentially much of it Jewish, essentially. Right. But yeah, and obviously this was a much different time in America when the vast majority of people were in fact Christian. So anyways, I thought that was an interesting aspect of it. And
add one thing, John.
Oh, go ahead.
Strategically, one of the greatest threats to Christians of any kind was Bolshevism or communism. So that, you know, I'm sure they were genuinely affiliated with Christians, but they also may have played that up because they were anti-communist, and the greatest threat to any religion and religious practice, religious freedom, is communism.
Yeah, that's very much true, and that was always on the forefront of any National Socialist mind at the time, because communism did represent such a major threat. And it certainly represented a threat in Germany, where in the 1920s, the National Socialists were engaged in a bloody street battle in many cases with communists trying to overthrow the government. And in some cases they did, for example, in Bavaria. One thing I wanted to mention, and this is something that I think a lot of people – well, I'm sure most people listening are aware of this, but like your average American, I don't think we realize the extent of German immigration to America and how significant of an ethnic bloc Germans were back then and still are to a certain extent today. I mean, they were a huge part of the founding and development of this country. And certainly back then they represented one of the largest ethnic groups in the country, right?
Was it 12 to 13%? I'm trying to remember that. I might have written it into the article. The German American percentage of the population. Yeah, well, it was. Let's just say it was quite significant and far beyond the 2% Jewish.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually just looked. I just Googled it. Yeah, 12.3%. This is today. I tend to think it would probably would have been more back then as a percentage of the population. But anyways, they were certainly a significant percentage of the American population and played a huge role in the founding and building of America. There's no doubt about that.
And one thing to say, sadly, really. Many Germans had to leave Germany during the Weimar period. It was so miserable. There was so much poverty and starvation. I'm sure they didn't want to. They were patriotic Germans. They loved their fatherland. But they were forced to leave and go to where they could to survive, basically. And that would be the United States, among others, but primarily the U.S.
Right, yeah, and a lot of these individuals served in the German military. They were veterans of the First World War. And a lot of them ended up, I think, most of the main leaders in the German-American organizations were, in fact, veterans, right, of the German military.
Yes, World War I veterans.
Yeah.
And some went on to serve with the Germans in World War II.
Yeah, very, very interesting. One more sort of general question, and then we can kind of get into some of the details of the article. Can you talk about some of the sources that you used for this article? We already mentioned the booklet of the Madison Square Garden speeches, but aside from that, what other sources did you consult? What did you find useful? What did you find maybe more biased? I mean, is there like a and see that's one other thing I wanted to mention is I think it's important what you're doing because there really isn't like sort of a objective, almost like pro look at this. At this period, this aspect of American history, it's all demonized, you know, the evil Nazis, you know, of course, by the establishment historians and the establishment press. But did you find any sort of like neutral sources or objective sources when it came to this aspect of American history?
Not many. I was able to basically like debunk some of the anti-National Socialist sources, you know, based on my own perspective that I've developed. But I would say Leon de Grelle's book Hitler Democrat. I think that's a title that Barnes sells. That's, you know, basically pro-National Socialist, of course. You know, that you see this source, the German-American Bund, the enemy within.
Yeah, exactly. That's how most of like the mainstream articles you'll see online. I know you cited like an NPR article when Nazis took Manhattan.
Right.
And it's just like so over the top, like anti, like just clearly not even objective or an attempt at authentic journalism. It's just, you know, propaganda essentially. And that's how a lot of these mainstream sources are anyways.
Yes, but some of them contain some very excellent depictions of American National Socialists.
Such as that's true.
Jewish Daily Bulletin. It really revealed that Adolf Hitler and the National Socialist Party were hugely popular in Germany, which is counterpoint to the ongoing Jewish propaganda that he was a tyrant and, you know, tyrannical over the German people. But one of the great sources here that's, you know, at least neutral on National Socialism is The Forced War by David Hagen. And Herbert Hoover's book, Freedom Betrayed. Herbert Hoover's Secret History of the Second World War and Its Aftermath. I referenced that in the article.
Yeah, and that's a book that I've heard of and I've seen it cited over the years, including in your article. And it's one that I've never read, but I need to put that on my list of books to read. That list is pretty high as it is right now. You know, you can only do so much reading, but
I know
that definitely is one that I'd really like to read. Considering just the source himself, you know, Herbert Hoover, former president. I mean, he really exposed a lot. But yeah, it's a book that I've never actually read.
I would say the booklet Free America was the actual verbatim quotes from the speeches of the Bund members at the Garden. It really says a lot of what we need to say. And I felt the same was true of the speeches of Adolf Hitler. One of our previous interviews, we talked about Hitler's olive branches. And the things the man actually said are really the best sources of, like you're asking, you know, what sources were not, you know, propaganda and demonization and the things these people said themselves is the best source.
Yeah, and of course that's always conveniently left out of these more establishment type articles that you see in NPR. Or I remember reading an article in The Atlantic that had some outstanding photographs of you know, the German American Bund and like their camps on Long Island and, you know, some of the rallies that they held and stuff like that, but you won't actually get to read or hear what these men actually said. And that applies equally to Hitler. You know, when you're taught about Hitler in school, you're never actually presented with what he actually said, right? I mean, it's always just this over the top demonization. So yeah, no, I think that's important. And you do have some great quotes from some of these German American Bund leaders in the article. But let's actually start at the beginning, because the German American Bund wasn't formed until I think 1936. And there was a few other organizations that sort of led up to the German American Bund. And the first one that you talk about is the Free Society of Teutonia, which, if I'm not mistaken, was formed by three German immigrant brothers, Fritz, Peter, and Andrew Gesibel, in the Chicago area, right?
That's right. Gesibel, or however we say that, the Free Society of Teutonia, founded in 1924.
Yeah, interesting. So this would have been like the first like large scale German American organization, right?
Oh yes. This was the first, and you know, they had that same platform as I spoke of earlier, nationalism, opposing Jewish power, anti-communist, and they're openly opposed to the Treaty of Versailles. They wanted revision of the Treaty of Versailles, but they also were proactive. They were promoting German-American culture, language, and identity, holding cultural events, you know, continuing to speak the German language and teach it to the youth. German festivals and, you know, historical and cultural events. you know, they felt like in America, like many immigrant groups did, that their native culture and traditions and language could erode. So they made efforts to maintain that.
Yeah, that's an interesting aspect of a lot of these groups was, you know, a lot of them operated as like cultural organizations where, you know, like you said, they're trying to maintain the German language and maintain a sort of German identity and German culture in America, like an American version, right?
Yes, and they felt that was fully compatible with American values, American culture, and so did many other Americans until, you know, the Jewish propaganda got going and the demonization of Americans began and the melting pot theory was promoted. But the Free Society of Teutonia changed its name in 1926 to the Nationalistic Society of Teutonia. In these kind of ongoing attempts, they have to align themselves better with American sentiment. You know, they by that point, they were established in seven different cities. And Fritz Jacibel was the treasurer. And it emerged in the 1943 FBI sedition trial that in 1926, the Nationalistic Society of Teutonia had raised money and sent it to Adolf Hitler in prison, right? Hitler and the National Socialists were in the Landsberg prison for their putsch attempt the year before. So this was actually evidence used against the Teutonians. Oh, they were that bad. They actually sent money to Hitler in prison. So, which of course at the time wasn't anything bad.
I was going to say, what is exactly illegal about that?
Well, the sedition trial actually, it accused Fritz of, this is actually later news, but you know, it didn't really stick. The accusations failed, but they did discover that they had been sending money to the National Socialist Party. You can't send money to a person in jail, can you?
I mean, I know. Yeah, I know. Today, like in our modern America, yeah, you can send money directly to prisoners. They have like a prisoner account. I'm not sure how it worked back then.
No, I don't know, but they, you know, this was their. The Teutonians were quite thrilled with the National Socialist Party in Germany. They were, like so many Germans, they were just so very excited by the prospects of national revival under the National Socialist leadership, which of course was quite obviously the case. But by 1932, they changed their name again, Friends of the Hitler Movement. So they were openly declaring themselves like fans and followers and advocates for the Hitler movement in Germany and, you know, seeing the benefits of that in America as well. This is when Heinz Schwanknober emerged onto the scene. He was he had been an NSDAP member in Germany and actually marched in the putsch attempt in 1923. So he was a core member. But here he was in America. And he had orders to essentially disband the Friends of the Hitler Movement, the original Teutonians, in 1932, because, you know, this was just months before Hitler was granted appointed the chancellor role, which he took up on January 30th, 1933. So just months before this group in America disbanded at the orders of Heinz Schwanknober. He'd been a recent immigrant, and he went on to shift the members of this group into a new group called Friends of New Germany, which we'll talk about later. And I want to mention Walter Kapp, K-A-P-P-E. He went on to become the press secretary of the German-American Bund, and he was a kind of German-American Willis Carto. He founded a number of publications, including the German Wake Up Call and Observer newspaper, which kind of amused me. I feel like we need a American Wake Up Call publication, which is maybe what American Free Press is.
Right. Yeah, we definitely need more of those types of publications.
I know.
You know, and I was thinking just earlier this morning when I was kind of going back through the article, and coming across this newspaper that they founded. I wonder, wouldn't it be interesting to go back and read the archives and see what they were writing about? I wonder also, were they writing in German and English, or I'm not even sure.
I'm not either. That's a good question.
It would be interesting to read some of these archives of these German American publications to see, you know, how they were covering the situation in Germany, their messaging to the American, you know, to the American people. That would be fascinating. I'm not sure where those archives could be, you know, found at, but that would be that'd be a worthy research project right there, I think.
Yeah, it would. One of the fascinating things we'll probably find is that they were writing about the same issues and in a similar way as we are today.
Yep, exactly. Yep.
I was kind of stunned by what these groups were writing about and presenting, what their platform was, what their issues were, who their enemies were, what their solutions are. So similar to what they are today, except, of course, today only so much worse.
Yeah, that's so true. Go ahead.
Just to wrap up on Walter Kapp, one of the friends of the Hitler movement. He left the United States and joined the Abwehr, the German military intelligence, Abwehr II, which was the special operations department. And he helped arrange for tiny, like two-man submarines to come and patrol and surveil the east coast of America during the Second World War. I think the Barnes actually has an essay on that. I've seen pictures in the Barnes Review of these tiny submarines, like abandoned or, you know, derelict, if that's the word, on the beaches of Norfolk, Virginia, or coast of Maine. Imagine that. They were sending these tiny submarines to the United States to surveil the probably most of it, the Lend-Lease Act shipments going to the Soviet Union to replenish the Soviet war supplies.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. So to kind of pick up in the article, I know you, the next section is an organization called GAU USA. And was that was that a totally separate organization from the Teutonia Society and then some of the organizations that came after that? Or was that part of it? Did it sort of morph into GAU USA?
No, I wouldn't say so. It seems like there's always some degree of overlap of members, but it seemed to me that GAU, meaning region, was essentially an independent group.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
Ideologically aligned and affiliated, but they came about in the late 1920s and, you know, had offices in several U.S. cities, NSDAP affiliated, you know, back to the German group. They disbanded in 1933 after Hitler became chancellor. It was thought that their efforts were no longer needed, you know, which, you know, isn't quite true, but the Germans were concerned about their influence in America. You know, they're so enthusiastic, but they had to be a little more circumspect promoting Germany with the, of course, at that time, the international Jewish boycott of German goods came about. So they had to.
That would have been like right after Hitler took power in early 1933.
When they disbanded.
The boycott. Yeah, exactly. Yep.
I think I have a date, which would be very interesting, because on March 24th, 1933, 7 weeks after Hitler's taking the chancellor role, the Enabling Act, the real name was the Law of Plenary Powers, was passed by the German parliament, and the National Socialist Party was granted full leadership of the nation with no interference by any other political party. That was passed by 82% of the vote of the parliament. So that's an important date. I think the GAU was disbanded prior to that by Heinz Spanknobel. He was the Detroit leader of the GAU, and he went to Germany at this time and you know, consulted with the German leaders there, and he was then given permission to form a new group called Friends of New Germany.
Okay, right. And this Friends in New Germany, this sort of like incorporated all these previous organizations together, right?
That's
Like
right.
all the different members, yeah, they sort of, kind of disbanded and organized into this new Friends of New Germany. Yeah, interesting. And this had, and again, Friends of New Germany, this organization did have direct ties to the National Socialist government in Germany, right?
Yes, they did. Like I just said, Spanknobel was given permission to form it by the German National Socialist leaders. And they had some influence in shaping of it, but they trusted Spanknobel and others to lead that. This is where Jim Bridemus's source comes in, the failure of American Nazism, the Bund's attempt to create an American fifth column, which has some good information if we can sort through the fear-mongering and the propaganda. But really, to answer your question, the German consulate in New York City, Diekhoff, I think was his name, he directly helped to establish the Friends of New Germany. So he was closely associated with the founding and operation of the Friends.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, and this is where you get into you actually have a nice excerpt from an article that you can still actually find online at the Jewish Telegraph Agency, their archives. It was originally posted as a Jewish daily bulletin on April 30th, 1933. You want to talk about this article? Is pretty revealing, pretty interesting information from an explicitly Jewish news outlet, right?
Yeah, at the time it was called the Jewish Daily Bulletin. I found this fascinating. These Jewish groups were reporting on the Friends basically refusing to disband and diminish their activities because they were just too enthusiastic. Friends persist despite consulates dissolving it. Jewish Daily Bulletin. Well, there's a quote from the Friends leaders in the Jewish Daily Bulletin that said, quote, "So long as Jewish persecution propaganda continues to be broadcast, we will continue to deny inaccuracies."
Yep, yeah, sounds about right.
That's rather pertinent today. popular literature was being distributed by the Friends that this article in the Jewish Daily Bulletin mentions how popular the literature of the Friends was. They couldn't print enough of it. People were eager to get it and read it. The Friends went on to speak at every German commercial and social organization in the city. So they were reaching out far beyond their own meetings and attending meetings of other German-American groups, making alliances, sharing, the good word. I don't know if you want to quote directly from the article. I have an extensive quote from the Jewish Daily Bulletin. It's really quite long. It's unusually long. I thought it was so pertinent. It was just so excellent.
Yeah, if did you want to read the excerpt?
I want to select some of it, or maybe you do. Let's see.
I mean I have it pulled up here. I've got the whole PDF of the magazine up. I'm trying to think. Yeah, it is pretty long.
Let me just mention the sub headlines. Meeting not canceled, right? The Friends refused to cancel their meetings. Tons of propaganda. These are the sub headlines by the Jewish publication. Hitler praised at rally. That was Dr. Keip. He was the consulate, the German consul. He actually spoke at this meeting of the Friends. And the Jews thought he was kind of aligned with them and friends of Jews and kind of a liberal philo-Semite. But here he is at this meeting and he's saying things, very pro-Hitler. Let's see if we can get to his quotations. "Hail the Chancellor," Dr. Keip cried, and concluded with an expression of hope that the political leadership of the present government by the Chancellor, in cooperation with President Hindenburg, would prove to be a blessing to the German fatherland. Well, it certainly was. Dr. Kipe described the inner political development in Germany during the last years, which led, according to him, to the logical necessity of the National Socialist Party taking over the government. He emphasized the importance of the fact that as a result of the March 5th elections, there was created for the first time in years a working majority in the German parliament. Chancellor Hitler's achievement has succeeded in obtaining for him a popularity among the German masses, which no other chancellor since Bismarck had attained, said Dr. Kipe.
Interesting. Yeah, and it also notes that there was 1,200 people at the meeting, which is a pretty large meeting, to say the least.
Yep.
Yeah, and this was, you know, organized to celebrate Hitler's 44th birthday. And they even had a Colonel Edwin Emerson, who was the head of the American Friends of Germany. He also addressed the group. So this was a pretty large, well-attended gathering. It featured pretty prominent individuals in American society, certainly a lot of, you know, certainly amongst the German American community. And it sort of showed that this was a very sort of, I wouldn't necessarily say mainstream, but it was an acceptable, legitimate organization. And, you know, what they were talking about was sort of a, you know, acceptable discourse in America at the time, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, most certainly. As the anti-German propaganda got developing ever since early 1933, you know, that was a challenge. They faced that kind of environment. But certainly many ethnic European groups in America were well-organized and well-received and quite active. So certainly the Germans were as well.
Right. So what happened with the Friends of New Germany and how, what, like, when did, can you talk about like the timeline between the Friends of New Germany sort of ending and the German-American Bund forming and really gaining prominence in the mid-1930s?
In 1935, the Friends had been supported by the NSDAP in Germany and the consul. But then Rudolf Hess recalled the leaders to Germany. They had the same concerns. The Friends were challenging the reputation of Germany. And, you know, the German leaders wanted them to tone it down and transition it to more American patriotism. And this was also the time when, what's his name, Samuel Dickstein emerged. He was a Jewish New York senator in the, you know, in the Federal Congress.
Soviet agent as well, a point that you make in the piece.
Imagine that. Imagine the hypocrisy. Imagine
that, a Jew being a communist agent. Weird. That's not the first or last time that's happened in American history.
In the U.S. Congress. Well, the real irony, if that's what the word is, I call it a chutzpocracy, a chutzpah hypocrisy, was Dickstein formed the Special Committee on Un-American Activities authorized to investigate Nazi propaganda and certain other propaganda activities. You know, that went on to become the famous Un-American Activities Committee, the House Un-American Activities Committee. But at this time, they were like formed to investigate Nazis and un-American Nazis. Meanwhile, Dickstein, the guy that formed this committee, he's about as un-American as you can get, right? He's a Jewish Soviet agent.
Yep, exactly.
he's selling illegal passports and immigration papers to bring in more Soviet spies. I just found that outrageous. So they began to investigate the Friends, and they did determine that it was a branch of Hitler's NSDAP in America, which, you know, it was, and that doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, a scandal or a threat. But the committee did rule that the Friends were acting within the law. So they weren't, you know, overtly found to be illegal.
Interesting. Yeah, no, that's a pretty interesting conclusion to come to. You know, they spent all this time and resources and money investigating these groups, only to find out that everything they're doing is perfectly legal.
Right. But so it was really, again, the German leadership that, you know, basically ordered the Friends to disband again. And then they shifted them once again to really the final National Socialist affiliated German-American group. And really the biggest in history, the German-American Bund. Bund is a word that means People's Association.
And this was the one led by Fritz Kuhn, who's pretty infamous in American history, right?
Well, in a way of similar to George Lincoln Rockwell, he would be famous among, you know, another contingent. It was very kind of flamboyant and charismatic, a very dramatic leader of the Bund, Fritz Kuhn. The Bund was open once again to only German American citizens. That was one of the striking things about these early groups, is they were only German Americans, or so we're told. You imagine they might have made exceptions for some, you know, Irish National Socialists or Austrian or Baltic people, but we are told that they were only open to German Americans. And the Bund formed in Buffalo, not New York City, and it was modeled on the NSDAP in Germany. And these were this was the group that formed the like the summer camps and the kind of recreational camps and cultural settings where the youth would go and play games and speak German and learn history, and the adults as well. These camps were in New Jersey, Long Island, and Wisconsin.
Yeah, and let me just mention, in the magazine, we've got some very, very interesting photos of some of these Bund camps and some of the activities. Like, we have there's a really cool photo of a parade taking place at one of these German-American Bund summer camps on Long Island. And yeah, it's just fascinating. You can see a whole crowd of American citizens sitting there giving a Roman salute as the Bundists march past. Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
I wonder if that's the – I have the draft version. There's a picture of the Bund members at a camp, like, with a mock cannon. They're pretending to be this cannon crew, you know.
Yeah, no, that's also in the magazine as well. And that – if you look at that photograph – they actually have a sign right below it where it's kind of hard to read exactly what it says, but you can clearly see that Representative Samuel Dickstein, the Jew from New York that was targeting the German American Bund. So they're sort of like, you know, it's sort of like a mock, they're like targeting this this guy that's targeting them. It's pretty, yes. Pretty interesting.
One of the things the sign says is, attention, specimen of armed Nazi might. Something directed at Camp Siegfried, representative
by Representative Dickstein. Yeah,
discovered at Camp Siegfried by Representative Dickstein. There's some very good dark humor in all this.
Yeah, then, yeah,
it's off the charts now. I get so many great laughs from some of the memes today. So they, you know, they were of good humor, and these were, you know, people classically devoted to National Socialist health and fitness, you know, family values, you know, healthy relations between men and women, everything that the cultural Marxists opposed. And, you know, it has to be said, those are, of course, fully American values at the time as well. But the thing about the Bund, They added to their platform opposition to the election of Roosevelt. They called him what did they call him? It's a name that sounded Jewish. They called him
Rosenfeld.
Rosenfeld, maybe. Yeah.
I know I've heard that before. And there have been allegations that Roosevelt did have distant Jewish ancestry. I don't know if that's true or not, but either way, he essentially did the bidding of them, and his entire administration was just littered with Soviet agents.
Right. So the Bund was, you know, campaigning against Roosevelt, and he was communist affiliated and Jewish dominated. And but they ended up going to the 1936 Olympics, some of the leadership, including Fritz Kuhn. And they visited with Hitler at the chancellery, you know, for handshakes and photographs. And some of the sources I studied said that, you know, the National Socialist leaders snubbed them and kind of insulted them when they were in Germany. But that appears to have been untrue, you know, similar to the way they said Hitler snubbed Jesse Owens at the Olympics. But totally false, just demonization propaganda. And the Bund members were very inspired and encouraged by their meetings with Adolf Hitler and returned to America. And by 1938, they also visited with Goebbels and Goering. And that's when they changed their iconography and their platform to a more U.S. patriotic depiction, although maintaining their fierce opposition to communism and Jewish power in America. They formed a self-defense security group similar to the SA, the Sturmabteilung, which they called the Ordnungsdienst, the OD. And it was the OD that was a strong presence at the Garden event for security, which they, as it turned out, they very much needed.
Yeah, it's interesting. Do you want to talk more about the Madison Square Garden pro-America rally? That's the way it was sort of portrayed, you know, on the signs and stuff leading up to the garden. And this would have been February 1939. What struck me was, one, how many people were there, 20,000, even according to mainstream sources. And secondly, the fact that the police more or less kept the radical left and the Antifa of the time, which, I mean, you can even read on the Jewish Daily Forward, for example, that Antifa is a Jewish organization that was founded back in the 1920s to basically attack Nazis and to stop National Socialism. But the police at the time more or less kept them in check and did allow the rally to take place, something that obviously would not happen in modern America. I mean, all we have to do is look at Charlottesville, for example, and see how that was totally sabotaged and allowed to be disrupted. And you know, basically the police allowed and encouraged violence coming from the left, targeting the people that were trying to attend the rally.
Right. Just to clarify something, in my understanding, this comes from the great British historian Nesta Webster. The International Anti-Fascist League formed out of basically the communists that were expelled from Italy in 1922. And they went on to other places in Paris and formed up into the Antifa. But yes, there was soon after there were groups that were directly opposed to National Socialism as well. But yeah, you could say the Antifa of the day was there in large numbers protesting. And the mayor of New York, LaGuardia, deployed 1,700 police officers, the largest police force ever in American history at the time, to protect the rights of free speech of the Bund.
Even more astonishing is LaGuardia had Jewish ancestry himself. And he was certainly no fan of the Bund, but he, you know, he did, you know, I got to credit where credit's due. He did allow the event to take place and even used his police force to ensure their free speech rights, which, again, is something that I don't think we would see happen in America today.
Some of the protesters tried to get into the garden and they were prevented by the police. Although I didn't write about this in the article, but there was an incident where some Jewish activists like rushed the stage and tried to tear down the microphone during one of the speeches. And the OD, the Ordnungsdienst, basically pounced on them and pummeled them and hauled them off. And that was all depicted in the next day's newspapers as like these awful Nazi thugs picking on a poor, helpless Jew, you know, typical.
Right. But, yeah. I've even seen footage of that, actually. You can still find it on the internet.
Oh, really? That would be thrilling. I think I did see that during the research. One of the more interesting things was, and this is a theme throughout, like the battles between National Socialists and fascists generally and communists, they like try to overlay themselves on each other's talking points, on each other's geography, on each other's symbolism. So in 1937, the Jewish Joint Boycott Committee held its own rally at the Garden, you know, to promote the boycott of German goods. So I'm speculating that the Bund held their meeting at the Garden to overlay it on the German Joint Boycott Committee. Excuse me, the Jewish Joint Boycott Committee. You know, just in the same way they held the Nuremberg trials at the place where the National Socialist Germans held their great rallies. You see what I'm saying? It's a kind of demoralization strategy to take over the other team's territory. So, and it was a huge success, the Garden event. It was held on George Washington's birthday, February 20th, not Adolf Hitler's birthday, April 20th, which makes me wonder if they assigned Inauguration Day to February 20th in honor of George Washington, incidentally. So they had six speeches. What I really want to get to, John, if we can, is the 8 points of the German-American Bund, which were presented at the meeting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no problem. I know you list them in the article.
Let me go through them quickly and think about how these would apply today. I actually saw the 10 points of, you know, contemporary American National Socialism in an article by Thomas Dalton on American Vanguard. And think about how these would apply today. One, a socially just, white, Gentile-ruled United States. Two, Gentile-controlled labor unions free from Jewish Moscow-directed domination. Three, Gentiles in all positions of importance in government, national defense, and educational institutions. I'm sure everyone understands Gentile means non-Jewish. Four, outlawing of the Communist Party in the United States, prosecution of all known communists for high treason. Five, immediate cessation of the dumping of all political refugees on the shores of the United States. Bingo. Yep,
exactly.
Six, thorough cleaning of the Hollywood film industry of all alien and subversive activities. Spot on. Seven, cessation of all abuse of the freedom of the pulpit, press, radio, and stage. Right on. Eight, a return of our government to the policies of George Washington, including aloofness from foreign entanglements and severance of all connections to the League of Nations, and today it would be United Nations.
Hard to disagree with any of those, I got to admit.
They're even more urgently needed today in slightly adjusted forms. So,
by the way, let me just mention, I'll send you a link to this in the Skype chat. I just pulled up an article. I remember reading this back when it came out. The headline here is, it's from the Times of Israel. The headline is, when a Jewish laborer took on 20,000 U.S. Nazis in Madison Square Garden. They made a short documentary film about this guy that attempted to disrupt the rally in Madison Square Garden. Right. And there's you can watch it on YouTube. It's like a, I think I said like a 7-minute video. I'll put it in the chat here if you want to take a look at it.
I have seen that.
Pretty interesting. Yeah, it's pretty interesting. And you can see like even some of like the posters, and I know you actually mentioned this in the article, like some of the posters that you'd see at the rally were like "Stop Jewish Domination of Christian America." Mm-hmm. So these guys were very upfront about the problems facing the country, and were not at all afraid to expose the Jews, the Jewish role in all of this, communism, and these sorts of things. So very, very, very bold, very, very bold.
They were avid counter-Semites. Let me wrap up. It looks like we may have only 15 more minutes total. So just to summarize what happened to the Bund leaders after the un-American activities and Samuel Dickstein got through with them. Kuhn was indicted on embezzlement of $15,000, most of it from the proceeds from the Garden event, which would be $320,000 today. But, the evidence only showed they could only pin like a couple $100 on him, but he spent 43 months in prison anyway. Kuhn's was given 15 years in prison for subversion. Froboese and others were said to have committed suicide, although they may have been suicided. 24 officers of the Bund were convicted of conspiracy to violate the Selective Service Act, the draft. You can imagine they weren't about to go into the U.S. Army and fight against their German kinfolk. So, of course, they could have appealed to the Constitution on a conflict of conscience. But they were accused of violating the draft. And then Kuhn was eventually deported to Germany after the war. So they were destroyed.
So really, like, after this Madison Square Garden rally was really when the U.S. government came down on this organization and like, just actively, like, crushed it.
It appears to be true. You know, the outbreak of war between Germany and Poland was September 1st, 1939. So I don't have the exact dates. You know, you wonder, was it after the outbreak of war when the demonization of Germany just went off the charts in America? But, it was really off the charts already after the, you know, the 1933 law of plenary powers, and then came the Nuremberg laws in Germany, and, you know, Jews were hysterical. So that's the end of the Bund, and that's the end of the that period of National Socialism in America.
Yeah, fascinating read, for sure. Again, people got to subscribe to the magazine to get the full article, and there's some great photos in there, a lot of good information. Also, I'd recommend checking out the booklet for the Madison Square Garden rally that features pretty much all the speeches by all the major leaders of the Bund. That spoke at the rally. You can find it on archive.org. I'll post a link to it when I put up the podcast program. Great article, very interesting topic, one that certainly needs a lot of revision, a lot of objective analysis from our perspective, I think, from a pro-National Socialist perspective, and I think that's exactly what your article provides. And again, it is going to be part of an ongoing series. I know you've already written part two, which takes us up to, I think, like the 1980s, right?
Mid-80s, say 1985, and, you know, the post-Norman, George Lincoln Rockwell era.
Yeah, so that'll more than likely be published in the next issue of the magazine. That would be the May-June issue. So, again, this is a series that you know, readers can look forward to, and I'm sure we'll talk about it more in the future. Was there anything else you wanted to mention about this article before we kind of wrap up and talk a little bit about your Substack and your new book?
No, I don't think so. I think we pretty well covered it.
Okay, good. Yeah, no, and like I said, I'd encourage people to check it out in the actual magazine. A lot more detail, obviously. It's a great read, great photos, great information. So let's kind of move on and we'll kind of wrap up with these last two items. I follow you on Substack. You got a great Substack page. It's Taboo Truth. I'll have a link directly to your Substack page when I post the podcast program for people to check out. And you put up an article recently that I found fascinating. I didn't know that you were a nuke skeptic like myself. The article is titled "Nuke Mongering Again. Fear not, we are safe, at least from that." And you talk about Tulsi Gabbard, who recently spoke at an anti-war rally in Washington, D.C., called Rage Against the War Machine. And she was basically talking about how the conflict between Russia and Ukraine and, you know, America and the wider Western worlds basically it involved in this conflict on the side of Ukraine and how it could escalate into a potential nuclear armed conflict. And you were basically being quite skeptical of the very concept of nuclear bombs. In fact, you say directly in the article, "Please listen closely. There are no nuclear bombs. They had never perfected the technology. The Germans tried first and gave up, and they were the best physicists and wonder weapon inventors in the world. They were driven by the mother of invention, necessity. They invented the first jet engine, the first long-range rocket, the first nerve gas, but they gave up on nuclear bombs. They found it impossible to invent the necessary technology." And then you say, "No one else has succeeded since. They gave up trying. Hiroshima and Nagasaki were hoaxes. They were hit by incendiary bombs, just like Tokyo and all the other Japanese and German cities and towns." And I've been sort of interested in the concept that nuclear weapons are a hoax for a number of years, and I've actually interviewed a couple people about it in the past, and I'm pretty well convinced that they are actually fake, and the whole concept of nuclear weapons are basically form like a fear-based mind control program that's used to manipulate and exploit the world, essentially.
Yes. Yeah, precisely.
A pretty controversial opinion, but one that I think is at least worthy of considering. And there's a lot of interesting information out there that definitely leads one to be skeptical of the concept of nuclear weapons.
Yes. I mean, starting with the strategic uses of such a terror, you know, implanted in the public mind. Fear makes people easier to control. Money can be allocated and assigned. And three, you know, I mean,
you know, I just wonder,
oh,
I mean,
just the last point is you can like generate a dreadful enemy. These are like three of the great things that you can do with a fear hoax, and the fear of nuclear bombs has all three.
Yeah. Oh, right. No, I agree with you. And just the way it's used in the media to generate fear. Any time that you see the hysteria, the over the top fear mongering, I tend to be very skeptical of that particular narrative, because it is basically a way to control people, to mind control people, essentially.
Right. You know, viruses can do it. Evil Nazis. There's all kinds of fears. I was particularly captivated by the way Tulsi Gabbard made it personal and emotional. They do this all the time. That's what the Hollywood does, right? And the novels like On the Beach and Dr. Strangelove and Failsafe, they make this fear personal. So Tulsi Gabbard is describing this. You might remember the news. There was an announcement that a nuclear missile was heading for Hawaii. I think, was that in 2020? And so Tulsi is telling the story of how this man on some island in Hawaii had to decide whether he would race across the island in one direction and rescue one of his children and abandon the child on the other side of the island. And then there was another account of a mother that was like stuffing her child down a manhole into a sewer. And the child was terrified and didn't want to leave her mother. But the mother was trying to save the child. And, you know, you get this like strongly emotional circumstances. And that's just how they drive this propaganda fear. And here was Tulsi, you know, just doing it to the hilt, really, really coming across with the pathos. And I, you know, this is where we get some of our dark humor. It's like, it's basically literally pathetic.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I was when I saw that article, because I follow your Substack via email, so I get an email notification when you put up a new article. And as soon as I saw that, I was like, oh wow, I had no idea that Carl was a fellow nuke skeptic. You know, there's not too many of us out there, but I do think it's worth at least entertaining. I'm not like 100% convinced, but I do think that there is a lot of evidence to show that they probably are, you know, a fear-based mind control programming device used by the global power elite. Yeah. I'm certainly no expert on the subject. I interviewed a gentleman named Chris Caskey,
I listened to that interview.
Yeah, that was almost a year ago that I interviewed him. But he wrote a book called The War on Goyim, and he has an entire section just basically going over all of the research relating to this concept. So it's pretty interesting. It's pretty detailed. We don't have time to get into all the details and all the different angles to it right now, but it's certainly worth entertaining at the very least. And there's also an interesting website. I think it's – what is it? I'll see if I can find it right now. I think it's nukelies.org, if I'm not mistaken.
It's mentioned in the interview with Caskey or Casey.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
While you're looking.
Yeah, here it is.
Oh, you got it?
Yeah, it's big-lies.org, and then they have a section – dealing specifically with all the research into, you know, nuclear weapons being fake.
I'm
anyways, it's worth checking out.
I'm still pretty new to the new Cokes, but I've developed a conceptual framework over the years since 2015, since I've been awakening. And I find that this framework is excellent for allowing new information to incorporate into it or to leave it out. And it's very little likelihood that the framework's going to change based on the new information. The new information changes based on the framework. And so when I encountered the possibility that nuclear weapons, nuclear bombs were fake, it wasn't that big a revelation to me because my framework was there. The revelation that the Holocaust was a hoax was a huge impact on my psyche. It was like it was very disorienting. But once that pillar of the framework was established, then other ones fit in, you know, with a lot less fuss. I don't find it disturbing that I've been tricked about nuclear bombs, you know, because it's much easier to understand. And I did a little research of the writings of Miles Mathis. You might know Miles Mathis. He has two essays, one called one about the Bikini Atoll tests and one about the Trinity tests in the Nevada desert. And he examines the pictures, you know, photographs of mushroom clouds and Oppenheimer and other Jews like poking around the aftermath of the blast site with like paper slippers over their shoes, you know. It's like, I mean, some of it's just completely absurd.
Yeah, no, I am familiar. And you actually link to some of these papers in that comment thread. Yes. Of your recent article on Substack. Yeah, no, it's definitely a big topic, and there's a lot that's been written about it and speculated on, and I think it's at least worth entertaining if you've never encountered the topic.
Yeah, I call them boogie bombs. That's part of my dark humor. I want to use the phrase boogie bombs.
Right. And by the way, you can go to it's nukelies.org. That'll take you directly to the forum where most of this information that I've researched over the years is. So anyways, interesting topic. I'm glad to meet a fellow nuke skeptic like myself.
And check it out on Taboo Truth and please subscribe.
Yeah, for sure. I would encourage people to do that as well. I'll have a link to it when I post the podcast program. And then one last thing before we totally conclude here is your article, or sorry, not your article, your book. First book that you've published, it's called Covert COVID Culprits. I just purchased a copy directly from the Barnes Review. You can find it at barnesreview.org in the book categories. If you just scroll down, and it's the latest book. It's under the latest books and videos category, and it's the very first one. This is something you've been working on for a while, I know. And of course, it's dealing with the personalities behind the COVID scamdemic, which was probably one of the biggest psychological manipulation, you know, psychological warfare programs that we've seen in our lifetimes, probably ever. And yeah, you kind of go through and identify some of the key people involved in this hoax, in this very, very evil, dark agenda that they've unleashed on the world in its aftermath.
Yes. Some of the chapters are versions of essays I published at the Occidental Observer. I call it an inquest chronicle for two reasons. This word inquest is suggestive of the Inquisition, when the Spanish Catholics were investigating the Jews that cooperated with the Moors, you know, in the Muslim occupation of Iberia. So I'm conducting a similar inquisition today. And a chronicle because I restrict my focus to the most epic 2 years in world history, perhaps, arguably, 2020 and 2021, when the COVID-19 scamdemic, panicdemic was unleashed on the world. And my inquest leads to, you know, quite a few Jews that were perhaps overwhelmingly Jews involved. And in fact, that was the topic of that literature you said was being passed out in Florida, the Jews behind the COVID scam.
Yeah, absolutely. That was one of them anyways.
So I really chronicle that. I codify that in this book. and the overwhelming Jewish influence in many different positions. There's 13 pictures of people on the cover, and at least 11 of them are Jews. Perhaps not Klaus Schwab, and I think not Bill Gates. But we have people like Charles Lieber, you know, at the Harvard nanotechnology experts selling nanotech secrets to the Chinese, which nanotech was used in the vaccines. Rochelle Walensky at the CDC and many others, you know, Cass Sunstein at the World Health Organization. Oh, many others. Of course, Larry Fink is on the board of the World Economic Forum. And on it goes. You can go through the chapters, and I try to identify the Jewish presence at many of the major organizations and think tanks and global groups that were pushing the COVID narrative and the vaccine rollouts, including, I should mention, Dr. Drew the Jew Wiseman at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine, who really perfected the DNA technology used in the vaccines. Ronald Perelman funding the school, being a Jewish hedge fund manager, particularly corrupt one as well. I guess maybe they all are.
Very interesting. Well, I can't wait to get my copy. It's on the way to me right now, actually. I just purchased it the other day, and it's being shipped to me as we speak. So I look forward to reading it. I would definitely like to have you back on to do sort of a deep dive into the book. So, yeah, I think we'll go ahead and wrap up, Carl. Thanks a lot, man. It's always good to catch up with you. Keep up the great work. I'm looking forward to part two of your essay series dealing with American National Socialism, a topic that definitely needs some revision and maybe a bit of a pro NS slant to it, so to speak. I think that Indeed. that's long overdue.
That part two is particularly dramatic. There's some amazing developments. But good speaking with you again, John, as always.
Okay. Thanks, man. Keep up the good work. I will be in touch, and we'll do this again soon.